Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Gentlemen, to the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, the sexiest 2 hours in talk radio, the most technically plagued 2 hours in talk radio, it's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation, in the sunny, slave South Pacific. Freaking gorgeous. And see, from Fukushima, it radiated, and everybody got part-time jobs and incandescent light bulb. It's really helped the economy. Speaking of helping the economy, the first article today, and I'll be covering the debate and what have you article in a second, but today's super wealthy just tiddlers on all-time rich list. I found the title of this article so ironically hilarious. Because I guarantee these dudes will not take into account a Rockefeller money. Yeah, so you have a Forbes 100 or something, and not a single name of a Rockefeller there, you know, they own like 10% of the economy or something ridiculous like that, and they don't make the rich list, apparently. You know why? Because they put all of their money into frickin' trusts where no frickin' asshole can see them. And then they rule you from behind. Iron curtain of some description with an iron glove. Smash the beast and everything out of you. Okay. The richest person ever to walk the planet was not, as it turns out, an Astor, Carnegie, or even a Windsor. Notice how he left out Rothschild and Rockefeller, just like I said. I love breaking down articles before I've even read them. Rather, it was a fellow named Mansa Musa the First. Mansa Musa the First, man, he does sound like a rich fella, who, if you haven't heard of him, ruled what used to be the vast Malian Empire from 1280 to 1337, a terrain now encompassing Mali and Ghana that was blessed with oodles of salt gold. He had to travel to Timbuktu and back 7 centuries to find the man with the most wealth ever is only one of the surprises of the list of the top 25 of richest people in the history of mankind, compiled and just released by the website celebritynetworth.com. Now, here's the problem here. You're going to have a look at wealth and celebrity and things like that. The most famous and the most dangerous people and stuff like that usually don't make the list. But ironically enough, this one might just want. So let's have a look at the top 10 most wealthy in the US. So it was meant to move all of the Malian Empire. Oh my God, I was totally wrong about this. Totally prejudged. Number two, Rothschild family, $330 billion banking dynasty from 1740 to today. It was the Rothschilds bank. Wasn't it? And anyway, and then John D. Rockefeller, $340 billion industrials from 1839 and 1937, did this. Instead of Okay, we've had some problems here. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Technical issues. Again, just like we were played with yesterday, I found a reason for that, actually. The entire network of... Sorry. Excuse me. We found a reason for the reason... we found an article explaining what happened yesterday on the show with Tila Tequila. Slingshot, the ISP that I use, went down, like, the whole ISP for like 20 to 30 minutes, and it affected, like, I don't know. It didn't even say how many people it affected. But, you know, that's what went down yesterday. But we also had some other problems with Skype and all this other stuff. So it doesn't explain everything that happened, but at least that one big thing where we were off the air for about 30 minutes. Yeah. Now, anyway, on with the list. John D. Rockefeller with the $340 billion, Rothschild family above him with $350 billion, Andrew Carnegie, $310 billion, and the Tsar Nicholas II of Russia with $300 billion. He was the last emperor of Russia before the Red Revolution, and that freed all the Russians from Tsarist tyranny and gave them a blessed communist paradise. Out of the frying pan into the fire with these matters. Number six, Osman Ali Khan, Asaf Jah, the seventh. It's a real messed up name. He was the, 236 billion? Last ruler of Hyderabad. I don't know. Had anybody ever heard of Hyderabad until today? Well, I've not heard it. Well, I can guarantee you people I'm reading around this list. Many of them not have heard of the Rothschild family or John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Carnegie or any of these people. Isn't that interesting? And dig this. Here's an interesting one. Muammar Gaddafi. $200 billion. He's the former Libyan leader, 1942 to 2011. And then, lastly, the only one I've actually heard of is Henry Ford. $199 billion from the Ford Motor Company founder, you know, 1863 to 1947, who actually built cars out of hemp, and then, incidentally, wealthy industrialist scumbags made hemp illegal for that very reason that it would threaten all the Rockefeller. Okay, like, dig this. If you do the move on the list, okay, you go down to number nine, Henry Ford, okay. And then you go up, number three, John D. Rockefeller, who blocked all of Henry Ford's energy-saving inventions and other things. and John D. Rockefeller's number three, Henry Ford's number nine. It just shows espionage and corruption frickin' pays. Doesn't it? So does dictatorship, as it turns out. Speaking of which, we have a very different president who has shown up, allegedly, on the stage. Headline, Obama comes out swinging to take claim to his job. His job, like he actually works for a living. I'm sorry. The presidency, nothing is funnier to me, okay? All right, like, I'm not bagging the president. I'm just saying that every single thing that they say is absolutely hilarious to me, okay? And if you feel that I'm acting a bit weird today, I'll explain why. I had to get up at 1 a.m. to be on a show at 2 a.m. and then I put in a full 8 hours work, and then had a little bit of a nap before coming back on the show today. So this is me with a couple of hours sleep and a full day's work already out under my belt before the day begins. So I apologize if I'm not quite up to scratch. How many other people were up at 2 a.m. to do 2 hours on a radio show for somebody else? I don't think many of you were. Be lucky. It's just me doing this. A very different president showed up to the second live television debate with his Republican rival Mitt Romney, giving a performance that may prove critical in influencing swing voters. Swing voters. Apparently, they're playing at the park with their kids at the moment. Okay. President Barack Obama climbed back into the race for the White House yesterday and did not hold his punches in a bad-tempered debate with Republican challenger Mitt Romney, which could prove critical for the outcome of the election. You know what will prove critical for the outcome of the election? Nothing! Because it's already pre-decided. A scumbag will be elected. That much I know to be true. In a markedly aggressive performance, compared with his first dismal debate with Romney 2 weeks ago, the president hammered the former Massachusetts governor on issues ranging from immigration policy, which Obama now has solved due to the DREAM Act, which says if you're an illegal immigrant in the United States, you're no longer an illegal immigrant and your children aren't illegal immigrants and you don't have to pay taxes, you don't have to abide by the law. It's just ridiculous. You look into the DREAM Act. I read out the specifics of it. I can't recall, honestly. But immigration policy. Let's allow all the people who are illegal here to remain illegal, except we won't treat them as illegal. We'll in fact, encourage them to keep doing what they're doing illegally. That's the DREAM Act in a budget. So, and then tax cuts to Libya. Now, tax cuts to Libya. In what way is the United States supposed to be taxing Libya? Wait, hold on a second. I read that wrong. Tax cuts to Libya. Okay, so they're not giving tax cuts to Libya. They're discussing everything from tax cuts all the way over to Libya. Now, here's the thing about tax cuts. What is the problem with cutting taxes? There ain't one, inherently, unless you're cutting it from people who already frickin' barely pay any tax and already frickin' own the means of production and already frickin' rigged the election with the fake money that they stole out of the Federal Reserve in the first freaking place. So what money are you cutting? It doesn't exist. You just made the money up, you asshole. It's ridiculous. We're going to stimulate the economy by giving a tax cut. Yeah, great. A few people who actually aren't completely frickin' destitute now will possibly get, you know, a little bit of extra change that they don't really need, and we'll get on down, right? Oh, that's good. That's going to stimulate the economy. No, it's not going to stimulate the economy because what they're doing is they're giving people tax cuts, but they're increasing the price of everything exponentially, so your tax cut doesn't frickin' matter. It just gets swallowed up by the bankers who inflate the currency. That is a hidden tax that they don't tell you about. Okay? It's like an interest on a loan. It's usury. Show me a law. You show me a law. Anybody in the United States or New Zealand or any other country that requires you, specifically, a free human individual with free choice and capacity in knowing contracting with the government are required to pay tax. Somebody show me that law. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. So when they debate about tax cuts, they don't mention the fact that they shouldn't be taxing your income in the first place. What they do is they come in. Okay, here's the scenario. You've got a shop in Hell's Kitchen in New York or something. Some dude with a... let's see if I can demonstrate this here. Some dude with a cheese cutter hat kind of walks in. He's carrying a cane and he's swinging it around and stuff like that. And you wonder, okay, what's this guy going to do? And what he does is he comes up to you and he says,
"Hey, friend, I got some bad news for you. You can't have your shop here no more."
Yeah, what are you talking about, bro? It's my shop.
He's just like, "I'm telling you, you can't have your shop here no more. The entire East Coast has been bought out by me and my colleagues, and you're going to have to be moving soon, okay?"
What are you talking about? How can you do this?
He said, "We're just doing it, okay? Now, in the case that you don't want to move, I'm going to have to increase your rent."
"What do you mean rent? I own this property. I don't have to rent it back to you."
No, now you do.
But why?
"Because I will kill you and your family if you don't."
It's like, holy cow, man. You're a criminal.
"I know. What are you going to do about it? You're not going to do anything. You know why? Because I got the guns. I got the military. I got the banking system and the judges all in my back pocket. There ain't nothing you can do about it. Just try it. Stick your head above the pulpit one time. One time. And we'll shoot you down. Or you can simply pay the extra money that we're telling you to pay and get no choice about it. And maybe if you're lucky, a few years down the track, we'll give you a little bit of a break from that. And we'll decrease the amount of illegal money that you have to pay us on the property that you own by like 5% or something. To say thank you very much for giving us this illegal money from and taxation on a property that you own and we don't for the past 20 years or something like that, okay? It'll be like a Ralph's Value Club card. How does that sound?"
You're like, "Well, it sounds like a pretty crappy deal, but I suppose I'll have to take it."
"That's right. Thank you very much for doing business with us. Good evening."
And he walks out and he goes into the next shop and carries on the routine. That's a tax cut. All right, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And we'll be right back after the break. TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. You can call in 218-339-8525. 218-339-8525. Show that's about shining bright. Now back on to this debate, they also discussed Libya. Okay, here's the Libya situation. Dude called Gaddafi gets the literacy rate up from like 20% to 80% in a couple of decades. He reduces the debt of the country to zero. He creates the most Western, technologically, at least, advanced culture in Africa. He creates a massive artificial man-made river that courses through the country, supplying water to people even in the forest desert so that they can all grow crops that where previously there was nothing but dust and sand. And then, using this oil wealth
He gives people like what a 50% on their car, on their first car, and gives them like 50 grand when they get when a couple gets married, so that they can put a down payment on a house, so that they got somewhere to live. He built a whole bunch of houses and stuff like that, and he said, "I will house all the people of Libya before I would house my own mother and father." And sure enough, his mother and father died before getting a house. Okay, that's Gaddafi. And then he says, "Hey, let's have an African Union, or rather, let's not have the AFRICOM idea, like a military dictatorship slash EU version of Africa, but let's actually have a league of African nations who are actually looking out for Africa, who are kicking out these big evil corporations who have been exploiting everybody since goodness knows when. Maybe that's the good thing to do here." And then he goes into the oil industries and he looks at it and he goes, "Well, look, all the oil's being traded in US dollars. Looks like it's artificially inflating the US economy and burdening all the oil-producing nations with massive amounts of debt and this kind of thing. And they've got this currency that's soon to be worthless. Well, how about I, instead of taking the oil that we produce here, give the US a cut, why don't we just sell it for gold? Gold, which has no debt inherently attached to it, no Federal Reserve or anything like that. We'll call it the gold dinar, okay? You know, like back in the day, like a necker and stuff with the dinar." And, of course, you got no debt. You're helping out the poor. You're creating a huge amount of debt-free trading. And you're making a stand, and you've got a state-owned bank that has ruled that interest and usury is illegal. So naturally, he's a brutal, evil dictator that must be stopped at all costs. Let's stop him, and let's send Al-Qaeda to do it. And that's exactly what happened. Okay? That's Libya. So whenever these politicians are talking about this, I don't know. But the Challenger also put in a strong performance, as Romney were talking about, attacking the administration's record on job creation as he reworked his campaign talking points. Job creation in the United States. I think they're more like practicing job evaporation. And the only jobs that you really get from that Obama's created are jobs working for the government. You know, what's going on here? These people keep talking about job creation. The way you create jobs is you teach your people about how to be self-sufficient, how to be independent. And you remove restrictions and compliance costs and all of this other red tape, taxation, etc., from businesses. So that when somebody has an idea in their head, he goes, "Hey, I can create a water-fueled car that had done this, that, and the other. Okay, cool. Let's run a working prototype." He does a little bit of research, builds a working prototype, gets it all going. Sweet as, not a problem. Then, as soon as he wants to go and take it to market, he's got all these business costs that are going to escalate taxation, and you've got to have accountants. And you've got to have a business premises. And if you've got a business premises, you've got to pay business premises costs and goodness knows what the frack else. Okay, so the guy just sits down and he thinks to himself before making his invention, before taking it to market, and he goes, "You know what? It just ain't freaking worth it." So he doesn't do it. And the economy is all the worse because now the small businessman, the person who is creative, the person who is actually the backbone of the US economy from day dot with creativity and entrepreneurship, is now got his hands cuffed and he's expected to keep working and creating jobs. It's not happening. And this is all part of the globalist. They are building in a whole bunch of things into the system. Kind of like speed bumps in a road, except the globalists don't drive on that same road. There's a secret road that they can go, that they avoid all those speed bumps, and they go around. Everybody else is still stuck in traffic, and they take the fast lane. And only they have the key to the gate. That's the real problem, is that you're taking away the capacity for local businesses and small business particularly. You're taking away the ability of them to even exist. And you grant exceptions for those laws to the massive globalist corporations who essentially make off with all the money in the economy, have virtually no creativity, no conscience, and wind up running the place because they're the only people with any money left. Middle class, gone. That's job creation. And anybody who's left has to get some kind of government job or get freaking food stamps. You know, you've got 40 million people on food stamps in the United States. What do you got? Population 315 million and 40 million are on freaking food stamps? They literally cannot even afford to feed themselves? I remember when I was, I think when I was a teenager, it might have been, I was looking up unemployment rates and poverty rates. And there was some kind of international website that I was looking at the time. And I noticed in communist China, the poverty rate is 10% and the unemployment rate was 10%. I thought, wow, in China, if you're unemployed, you're living in poverty. It's just that simple. And then you have a look at the United States. 4% unemployment and 14% living in poverty. It's like, oh, so there's actually quite the likelihood that even if you've got a job in the United States, it's so expensive to survive as a slave that you'll have to live in abject poverty anyway. That really sucks, man. Got more freedom in China, economically speaking. Unbelievable. Now, the audience at Hofstra University outside New York, which had been asked not to applaud, ignored that instruction and broke into loud clapping twice as the pair sparred over the administration's clumsy handling of the aftermath of the Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. You mean that consulate attack that never frickin' happened and was actually, like, taken... that footage was taken in like a completely different country, and it wasn't even a consulate. It was a safe house of some description. You know, the ambassador and three other Americans were left dead in the attack, which was originally described as spontaneous by administration officials. And I found it very interesting that during that protest, it wasn't a single cop. I've never been to a protest in my life. A protest that's not been called or not been officialized or anything like that. Any amount of people go into a particular area, boom, you got cops there, like white on rice. I didn't see a single cop at that alleged Benghazi consulate attack. Why is that? Obama, in a display of barely controlled anger, reacted strongly to Romney's accusation. He was fundraising in Las Vegas after the terrorist attack. You know what's funny about Las Vegas? It's run by the mob. How can you say that, Vinny? Well, dig this. If you want to launder money, you've got to have a casino, okay? Because if you were selling a product, let's say you've got a car, you've got to have rubber, you've got to have metal, you've got to have glass, you've got to have electronics, you've got to have... there's a paper trail for all these different products and things like that that you bring over, assemble in a plant, put out. Products, tracking numbers, scannings with the beep, 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 like in the supermarkets and stuff, barcodes. You know, there's a huge trail of that. You got a casino. You just go, hey, some dude just dropped in $100 million, you know, and lost it all. You don't have to explain where that money come from. You're in a casino. Perfect place to launder money. And who loves to launder money? Criminals. And guess who, incidentally, was campaign funding in Las Vegas? A criminal named Barack Obama. Hey,
are we starting to see the dots connected here?
Well, incidentally, you know, Romney's got similar connections with a whole bunch of drug dealing, cocaine smuggling, pieces of trash and stuff all over the place anyway. So, yeah. The suggestion that anybody in my team would play politics or mislead when we have lost four of our own, Governor, is offensive. That's not what we do, he shot back. You want to bet? a politician claiming that he doesn't play politics or mislead people. You've got to be freaking kidding me. These people have lost touch with the tenets of their job, if that's the case.
Oh, we don't manipulate people. We don't mislead them. You know, we don't play politics.
You're a politician. It is your job to mislead me. If I'm angry with you, it's because you haven't misled me correctly. Okay? Well, is there like a qualification form for this? You know, here's the presidential kind of test that you have to set. Okay. Are you a known sociopathic lying criminal? Yes. Do you have connections with money laundering scum? Yes. Are you funded by major corporate banks? Yes. Are you willing to sell out the American people and even sell out your own grandmother to get a couple of extra pennies? Yes. You got the job. That's what's happening here. It was one moment of the wide-ranging debate where Romney appeared to be flailing. Earlier, he rudely put the president in his place by snapping, "You'll get your chance in a moment. I'm still speaking," in an exchange about energy production. You know, what's interesting about energy production is that, well, we had the Keystone Pipeline coming down from Alaska to have natural gas and oil being flowed into the United States. Basically, it would make the United States self-sufficient. And Obama blocks it. Why? Goodness knows. Here's the idea. Energy in the United States is much like energy in New Zealand. It's owned by a cartel. Okay? In New Zealand, the cartel is owned by the government. And the government's now changing that so that they want to have a mixed ownership model where a cartel of private investors as well as a cartel of government scum will be able to collude together in order to rip people off even more. Okay, so that's an improvement, they say, to help the economy. and what they do with these energy compliance costs as well. Just as I mentioned before about the creation of jobs and everything like that, how they squeeze out the small businessmen and all that sort of jazz. Same deal with the energy economy in the United States, as far as I've heard it, mate. They've got these huge power plants and stuff all over the place that have just been, you know, they've had their consents just stripped. It's like, what the heck, man? We need more energy. We have a growing population. We have more technology. We have more people coming on online. We've got stuff to work on. We've got a whole lot of things going on, man. What are you doing? And here's what they're doing. And brownouts all over the states regularly, as I hear it. And now people have no choice. Okay? Only the government-exempted major energy companies really hold any sway now. And they got copious quantities of lobbyists, and they don't want any more freaking competition. And they don't want any more energy production either. Okay? The Seven Sisters Oil Companies, you may have heard of these. Well, you know what they did in order to control oil? They simply bought out all the competitors' oil refinery stations and freaking shut them down. Oil price goes right up, surprisingly. Same thing is happening with energy. Do you think it's the exact same methodology? Do you think it's not? Call in 218-339-8525. The rematch was substantively different from the earlier debate because its town hall format allowed questioners from among 82 undecided voters to pose questions directly to the candidates via moderator Candy Crowley of CNN. CNN, oh, you got to love how unbiased that must be. The last question gave Obama and Romney the opportunity to correct, quote, the biggest misperception about themselves, which enabled the Republican nominee to counter the impression he only cared about the 1% of Americans and to address his Mormon faith. Obama, for his part, denied that his administration was only about big government. Yep, misperceptions. That's what's truth in politics. We'll see you in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, at VinnieEastwoodShow.com.
People, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, saving. Then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Our number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. Hey, and speaking of misperception, okay, so here's the misperception about Mitt Romney. He only cared about the 1%. Who are all his friends? Who are all his donors other than the 1%? Are there any? Yeah, I'm sure there's probably a whole bunch of freaking idiots out there who just go, oh, this guy's great, you know, he's going to restore America. It's going to be fantastic. I'm going to donate some the last $20, you know, I may not be able to have the gas that I need this week, but I think you'll help the economy, so it'll be okay. No, 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 no. Those people, even if there were millions of Americans who donated little bits like that, it would be an abysmal tiny fraction of a huge quantity of cash this dude has raised. Okay, this is the first $1 billion presidency in U.S. history. Okay, and we're approaching $1 billion per candidate. Per candidate! Unbelievable. You have a look back in the 2008 election. God, it was a long time ago, eh? I'm getting old. Feels like. I'm getting old, but the game still stays exactly the same. So I feel youthful about that, too. Now, what was I talking about? Oh, yeah. 2008 election. You had a look at the campaign contributors. And they're like Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, and all these big banking cartels. It's like, frack. Are they funding Obama as well as McCain? Well, yes. Yes, they are. Okay. Okay. The world suddenly makes a heck of a lot more sense than me. They're a bunch of corrupt scum. That's about right. Sorry. Because you have a look at how much they gave. And they gave money to both candidates. But they gave Obama twice as much. In this election, Obama and Romney, I don't know, I haven't seen the figures. I would like to see them. But I'm guessing it's actually closer to half and half. They don't like either of the horses, this tells me. They ain't got no favoritism. They think, hey, both of the guys that we've got here are pure puppets. You know, Obama has proved himself to be a number one puppet master. Because he's done everything to expand the size of the government. This is, of course, one of the big misperceptions about Obama that he'd like to correct. I would think growth of government. Let's quantify this. What constitutes a growth of government? For me, it quantifies encroachment upon personal freedoms and things of that nature. It encompasses the taking over of things that are vital to the economy and other strategic resources and things like that, and putting them under direct government control and taking them out of the hands of private people. It also, as far as I'm concerned, expanding government also includes allowing private contractors and public-private partnerships, things like that. Where is the line? Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Can you tell the difference between government and private corporations now? You go into a government building, all the people working in that government building are contractors. Ooh. Is there a difference anymore at all? I don't think so. And that's the idea. So when Obama tries to cast aspersions to people who claim that he's expanding the government, you don't have to expand the government in order to expand the government. All you have to do is do heaps of public-private partnerships. He's done tons of them. He's given more money to the bankers than anybody else. You know, Obama is a dream to the banking cartel because he just gives them anything they want. You know, do you want $40 billion a month worth of mortgage-backed securities to be created up out of thin air and then leveraged? Obama goes, yes. Yes, we can. Do you want to keep protracted wars going in various battle zones around the world that you really shouldn't be there anyway? Yes.
Yes, we can. You want to shut down energy production in the United States and force everybody to pay much higher power bills? Yes, yes, we can. Hope. Change. False hope and change for the worse. You know, look, people thought that he was going to solve every problem in the in the GD country, man. They thought they would all get gold Mercedes. They thought that there was going to be government money raining out of the sky, and that all of a sudden the food prices would stabilize, and that people would stop surveilling all these people along the United States with illegal wiretapping. They thought Guantanamo Bay was going to close. They thought that the troops were going to come home. Not a single thing that he said he was going to do has he done, with the exception of becoming president. That's the only thing he said that he would do that he actually did do. He became president. Everything else that he said before and after the election and everything else that he did before and after the election are a complete misnomer. Okay? Doesn't matter. Nobody even listens anymore. Nobody even knows what he was talking about 4 years ago. Nobody remembers. Okay? Go back and have a look at the speeches and shockingly huge lies that he told all of us. You should be angry that you were lied to and totally misled. It was a cruel joke, a hoax upon all of us. Everybody in the world loved this Obama guy. Everybody in the world thought, oh my God, America's going to stop being such a frickin' fascist police state, neo-feudalistic, frickin' 1% ruled communist dictatorship ruled by banking cartel franks. It's all going to be okay. And it has only gotten worse. Now, during this 90-minute session, Obama landed punches where Romney is most vulnerable. He referred obliquely to the former governor's record policy of flip-flops, saying, what I've tried to do is be consistent. Is that not the most infuriating thing that you've ever heard in your life, considering what I just said? Okay? These people... Right. You just laugh at them, okay? Obama says, I'm trying to remain consistent. Obama says, I'm trying to create jobs. Obama says, I'm going to try and tax the 1% a little bit more. Take it for the cruel joke that it is. Hey, look at it this way. Think positive. Think positive. Despite the fact that your country's been destroyed around you, like there is no freaking tomorrow, and ensure that there will be no freaking tomorrow if you elect either of these characters. Okay? Despite that fact, you can at least have a few cackles at their expense. And I wonder why that these... I don't wonder why. I know why. Because, look. The amount of us that know what the real truth is, or even an inkling, I don't know what the real truth is, whatever the frack that means. But I do know that whatever we're being fed right now is patently, obviously, undeniably, and unequivocally a pack of lies from a bunch of lying wolves in sheep clothing, Fabian socialist, Freemason, satanic cult mofos. I know, and it's not funny. But for goodness sake, if you keep taking it all really, really, really seriously, your head will explode, okay? It'll be similar to the guy in the Monty Python movie who just eats the last wafer of thin mint and then explodes with the guts and stuff all over the restaurant. But the president has also criticized Romney's outsourcing of jobs when CEO of Bain Capital. Bain Capital. Yeah. Like the bane of your capital existence. And noted his low personal income tax rate. His parting shot was to vow to fight for the 47% of the population, famously described as a lost cause by Romney on the ground that they are on government handouts and consider themselves victims. As it was in his final statement, Romney could not respond. Well, look at it this way. Obama comes out and he says, I'm going to try and save the poor by manipulating them, all right? Poor people,
You know, what do you define poor as? Okay, because I know plenty of people who are intelligent ass, who ain't got a cent to their name, got nothing but debt, and they're living on the breadline, you know? Poor people who are stupid, on the other hand, oh my God. Oh my God. So easily led around. They're practically lambs to the slaughter. And it's not like I'm saying poor people are stupid or anything like that. I just... The people of this world are stupid. Okay? It's not opinion. It is absolute fact. If you don't believe me, go and ask political questions to any American that you see in the street, any New Zealander, any Canadian, any Brit, any Indian, anybody who's in a low socioeconomic area, and you ask them, who's your current president? Who is the president of your closest neighboring country? What are their policies? What are their parties? You know, these are real basic, simple questions. And you'll be absolutely astounded by the fact that virtually nobody knows. Nobody has any idea who Obama is. Nobody knows who Romney is. Nobody knows what they stand for. Nobody knows what they've done. Nobody knows who's backing them. Nobody knows what they're gonna do. And that's exactly the way they like it. Because that way, you'll still vote for them out of sheer ignorance and blind hope that maybe, this person will be telling the truth and it won't be like the other past 100 frickin' presidents that we've elected or whatever that have screwed us all over. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Show as fast as 2 hours in talk radio, a deadly serious show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. You tune in 5 days a week from 5 till 7 central, and we'll make things so serious that you'll bleed out of your eyeballs like an LRAD weapon gets used on crowds and stuff. That'll be fun, won't it? Right, my very special guest is the skeptical psychic. Now, a lot of people don't understand this, so I'm going to preface this conversation. Psychic ability is something that I believe everybody has. It can be trained, it can be tuned, it can be utilized, so long as you are willing to forget to a degree that there's a 3D universe that rules everything. It doesn't. Okay, there are two universes as far as I'm concerned that are side by side, the physical and the metaphysical, and one cannot survive without the other, kind of like in The Matrix, how the body cannot live without the mind. The body's here and the mind is somewhere out there, man. There's a whole lot of different things like strange coincidences, synchronicities, premonitions, all this sort of stuff, remote viewing, that is unexplainable if you're only looking in the 3D realm. So Nancy Duterte is the guest today, the skeptical psychic.com, and now she's a lawyer, ladies and gentlemen, a lawyer and a psychic. That's an interesting combination. It's kind of like Tabasco sauce and ice cream. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm really, I'm enjoying my Tabasco sauce on top of my ice cream right now.
Mm-hmm. I just thought about something very weird. It's actually out of a some kind of a novel that I read as a child. Anyway, Could you give us a little bit of a background or about how you actually kind of got into this? I mean, you weren't born a psychic or anything, were you? It just started. Did you develop it, or did something strange happen to you that brought it on, and then you started expanding on it? What?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I wasn't, I wasn't born with, in the sense that I had absolutely no clue that I had any psychic abilities. I came out of a really academic family. They thought psychiatrists were off the wall, so psychics didn't even exist. I mean, I have no psychics in my family. We never talked about it. And I had no experiences. I had, in retrospect, one or two very weird things that happened, but I couldn't explain them. So I thought, I'll just ignore that. And I shoved it, in the back of my mind, and there it stayed. I had a very powerful, spontaneous mediumship experience when I was practicing attorney in New York. I was invited to attend this workshop. It was for psychotherapists, and I was the only non-psychotherapist.
Were all the other therapists psychos, and you're the only one with a conscience, were you?
Yeah, something like that. And I ended up basically going well beyond what we were supposed to be doing, which was we were learning about intuitive gestalt psychotherapy. And I ended up basically experiencing a spirit who walked into the room and had to deliver the message for one of these psychotherapists. And I figured they were going to look at me like I was out of my mind, which maybe they did. I have no idea. But even that wasn't enough to really kick me over into this idea that maybe I could be psychic. I just wasn't interested. It wasn't part of my world. And it wasn't until I decided to try and help, actually, the guy who was developing this intuitive gestalt psychotherapy. He was supposed to be writing a book. And I called him up. I said, I've had a couple of dreams about you. And he said, well, I charge for that. And I said, well, I'm not paying you. But I had a couple of dreams that you were covered with mold. And he said, what do you think that means? And I said, I don't think you're writing the book that you're supposed to be writing about intuitive gestalt psychotherapy. So I think I write pretty well. So, if there's any way I can help you, I'm perfectly willing to do it. I could proofread or edit or bounce ideas, whatever you want to do. And he said, well, it's a little early in the morning. Let me think about this. And typical him, he didn't get back to me for another half a year. And in the meantime, I figured, all right, if he's not going to write this book, somebody's got to get it out there. So I'm going to write this book about the psychology of intuition. So originally, this book, which is just out on the market now, called Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, I thought it was going to be a book about psychology. And what I learned was psychologists could care less about intuition. They call it a bunch of other things like empathy, resonant empathy, transference, countertransference, which to me are very separate because they're controllable. Intuition is a loose cannon. And so I figured, okay, well, if they're not interested, let me see what the neuroscientists are saying about it. So I studied a lot of neuroscience. They were running faster than the psychologists. And I said,
there seems to be a phone off the hook on the background there, Nancy.
Nope, nothing here.
I hear some kind of a phone just going beep, 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 beep.
I hear it also, but it's not here.
That okay. Well, let's write that off to some kind of a psychic interference. Maybe we can take that and put it in the back burner, and we'll figure out what it means later. But anyway, continue.
Well, I'm sure there are many people interested in hearing what I have to say. At any rate, then I did sort of all of my research kind of exploded, and I started talking to psychics and mediums and medical intuitives and military people and artificial intelligence people and poker players and musicians and artists, you name it, anybody who could tell me anything about intuition. And I am answering your question, by the way. It's a long answer, but I finally got to the point I realized, well, I can't really talk about this unless I know how to do it. You can't talk about it like you could talk about like an intellectual or an academic subject. So I said, all right, let me just see if I can learn from the inside. So I got apprenticed to a very well-known psychic detective for about 10 years. And I also trained with a lot of mediums and medical intuitives. And I realized at a certain point, only after arguing with all my teachers a lot, that I actually had a certain ability. And that's when I decided, now I'm interested. And I wrote the book completely differently from how I had originally thought that it was going to be.
So what changed? What was it that actually determined that you do have some kind of psychic ability there? And do you think everybody has that? If only they would train and have these similar experiences, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. And that's the premise of my book, because I explain it in terms of the senses. And I think you're 100% right. We all have the ability. We're all born with it. We all lose it, or not all of us, but most of us lose it. And we can retrain it, but it takes a lot of discipline. And you have to do a little bit what you were saying. You know, the way that I explain this, I teach this in New York, but I explain to all my students, you have to stop thinking, and you have to stop having emotional feelings. Once you wipe all of that out of your head, you're left with sensations, and that's what you want to focus on, because the sensations, those are the vibrations that are surrounding us and giving us data about our universe, and they can be extremely accurate, but normally, you know, we dismiss it, we don't pay any attention, or, you know, once you start thinking, you start guessing. If you start guessing, that is the end of your psychic ability. If you start having emotions, like if I were trying to read you and I really wanted the best for you, that's going to interfere with reality, you know? So you have to get rid of all that in order to get just straight down to perception.
What makes us lose that perception? Is the system, because in my opinion, the system's built up, and you're sent into public schools, and even past that, you go to university, and all of these things, they don't seek to expand your mind at all. They seem to keep you in total tunnel vision, and you become an expert at ignoring things, right? And they teach you critical thinking, i.e. being critical of people who can still think.
Listen, I like critical thinking. I got no problem with it, but it's only one way. And what the people in academics don't get, and what skeptics don't get, is that they are looking through one set of rose-colored glasses. And they don't understand that there are actually other ways of processing information and thinking without thinking that will get you the answer, and it will probably get you there a lot faster and a lot more information a lot quicker. Not always. It's not 100%, but it puts you on what I call the superhighway of information. It'll get you there really fast. And I think you're totally right, that it has very much to do with how we get taught. There's a window of time. It usually happens between the ages of about 3 to 6. And it's in that window that most kids will demonstrate their psychic ability if they have it, and usually after that they lose it. But that's the same window that we have for learning a second language. And some people say that we all have the ability for perfect pitch, and we lose it in that window. Well, if you think about it, in that window of time, guess who's going to school for the first time? We all are. And we're all starting to learn language, and we're learning how to communicate in a particular format so that we can all understand each other. Language is sequential. You got to go from A to B to C to D in our sentences, in anything. And you have to do it in a logical framework. All of that kills psychic ability. And that's, I believe, that's absolutely why we lose it.
And do you think that there's a deliberate agenda behind this? Like there's, I don't know, like there's a conspiracy from up high to limit humanity's psychic potential so that we're far easier to enslave.
Yeah, I've heard that. I don't really buy it, but I've heard it.
Well, see, regardless of whether or not it's intentional, it's happening, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But what's happening also is you got more and more people out there who are understanding that they have the capability to be psychic. So it's all going back to the people again.
Well, in this world, it comes down to, in many cases, personal responsibility, and more or less. I've been talking with a bunch of people recently, and they're talking about how to be the how to be really, really big in this movement and things like that, and all these rules and all these protocols and everything like that that you've got to follow. And I just got to ask a simple question. Can you name me one person throughout history who followed all the rules and become an amazing superstar? Nobody. Okay? The people who actually excel in our society are the ones who actually learn to trust their intuition. You know, chips fall where they may type of mentality. It's a risk, true. But without great risk, there is no great rewards.
Yeah, I mean, I understand what you're saying. I think, you know, most of the people who have, you know, made it big and did it by sort of breaking the mold were breaking a mold but still thinking within a certain type of framework. They just picked different ideas and they broke the ideas. Thinking in a psychic way is a complete paradigm change. You have to change everything about the way you look at the world and the way you experience the world in order to get it. And most people, they don't realize that they're already looking through their own lenses. So they say, no, you're wrong. I don't see that. There's a reason why skeptics literally don't see the same thing that believers do. They are connecting the dots, if you want to call it, you know, the bits of information that we have out there in a different way. And so they literally see something different. Way I explain, we got bombarded by 11 million bits of sensory information every second of the day. We're only consciously aware of between 16 to 40 of those little sensory bits of information every second. So what happens to the other 10 million and whatever? They're getting to our body. And I believe that our body, even though they're not registering within the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum or the chemical spectrum of a particular sensory organ, like the eyes, the ears, the nose, whatever, they're registering on a molecular level. And those vibrations with that information are actually, they're getting to our brain. And I believe that our imagination is actually our largest sensory organism.
Do you believe that there might be some kind of communication between cells and things like that? Like, a microorganism, you know, just one tiny little organism, and a macroorganism is simply a whole bunch of tiny little organisms that have come together to produce one larger one. So I've got 5 trillion cells in my body, give or take, that produces this one organism called Vinny. Does that mean all these little cells in my body all have their own consciousness and their own response to stimuli and things like that, and I'm capable of picking up in some way? As they course through my brain, they can whisper things to me?
Well, people talk about, you know, all the cells having some type of holographic type of consciousness. I don't know whether it's holographic in that sense. I think there's a pretty good chance it might be. But clearly, if all of the cells in your body are completely replaced every 7 years, there's some major type of communication going on because you're still functioning at how old?
27.
There you go. So you're still together and cohesive as a human being. I think what happens is that this information reaches our brain, and our brain tries to image the information in a way that we understand, that's already coded. So, you know, our eyes, when we look at, we look at something like a red apple, you know, we've understood our eyes and our brain and everything else. We've translated all those little electrical signals so that we say, oh, that's a red apple. I think that what happens with this other information that doesn't get sent through our eyes or any of the five senses, but gets to us, gets into our physical being, that information gets rooted to the brain, and the brain says, oh, let me see if I can describe it to myself, kind of like a red apple. And that is psychic information.
That is interesting. Also, you talked about skeptics before, and my sister invited me to a skeptics meetup one time, and they were talking about GMO food and the possible dangers and things like that. And the person was just this university graduate who came out and financed by Monsanto and stuff like that, saying GMO is all good, there's no problem. And I talked about this article that had come out about how they don't serve GMO food in Monsanto cafeterias. And this other skeptic over there turns up on her little smartphone, and she does a Google search. And she goes, look, we're skeptics here. Have a look at the websites that you've got here, beforeitsnews.com, da-da-da-da-da. And I go, whoops, I apologize. I didn't realize that you don't apply your skepticism to mainstream media as well, and you're only skeptical of alternative media. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Welcome back!
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's a show that's all about being a little bit operatic. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's not exactly a baritone, but I'd appreciate it if you'd donate me a tenner or two or three. My very special guest. Yeah, I do that. Shameless self-promotion. I'm of the belief that there is nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion by very definition. So, Nancy, I would love it if you would actually shamelessly plug your book.
Oh, funny you should ask about that. I would be delighted to shamelessly plug my book. It's out on the market now. It was published in August, and it's out there right now. It's called Psychic Intuition, Everything You Ever Want to Ask, But We're Afraid to Know. And it's available. I don't know what you have in New Zealand. Do you have Barnes and Noble stores there?
I don't know. I mean, are you selling it online, Amazon, something?
Yeah, I sell it. Yes, of course. It's online. It's on Amazon. It's Kindle, Nook. As I said, Barnes and Noble, independent bookstores. I've seen it a bunch of large department stores, that kind of thing.
It is really cool when you walk into some kind of large official place and stuff like that, and you see your work available for sale. It's like, wow, that's cool.
Yes, it is really cool. I agree with you.
So, in terms of the book, what's actually in it? And if let's say somebody know nothing about what you do and your areas of research or background or something, what would you hope that they would take away from the book?
Oh, a whole lot. And with the feedback that I'm getting from people is that I'm having people actually reading it several times and telling me that they're getting tremendous amount out of it in the first and second, sometimes third reads, because it's just loaded with information. Let me give you the whole premise of it. My background, as you mentioned, I'm an attorney. I am specialized in securities litigation. I've run a bunch of businesses in my life, and I did this kind of strange detour into this realm, not because I thought I was going to do it, but it just happened that way. But I think I wrote this book so that I could create a bridge between skeptics and believers. And also because I wanted to show everybody, I wanted to show skeptics in particular, but also believers, why psychic ability is real. It can be explained in terms of science. And it's not this like magic voodoo stuff that we all seem to think it is. And you don't have to be born with it. So you don't have to, bow down to people if they tell you that they, were seeing, grandma walking around when they were six and seeing auras and making prophecies or predictions and you weren't. The fact is we can all do it. And so what I do is I explain it right from the beginning in terms of our senses. So I talk about our five senses. I talk about why there's no such thing as a sixth sense. I talk about why women are more psychic and intuitive than men. I talk about the psychic senses, all of them. And I explain why psychics are not psychotic. So that's sort of the overview on it.
So I was just thinking about this. You got to bring things together, and usually when things come together, new things are created out of it. So you're trying to bring together skepticism and a scientific knowledge of what being psychic actually is, and physically and scientifically how it truly works. What do you think will be created if you bring the skepticism and knowledge of this together?
Well, what happens is you get a mainstream acceptability of psychic ability and the value of psychic information. or intuitive information. Right now, we really discount it. You know, we say, you haven't backed up your facts. You're kind of guessing, or you're just going on a feeling. You can't really go with that. So we dump incredible amounts of valuable information that we could be using in every single field. And for example, I strangely became a better lawyer after I did all of my psychic training. I never thought that would happen. So I know if that's going to work in a field like law, you know, which is all fact-based and evidence and persuasion and all that, it's clearly going to work in no matter what field you're in, which is why I think everybody ought to be paying attention to this. So if I can explain it in a way that skeptics can say, oh, okay, I think I buy that, or I can buy a lot of what you're saying that explains this, I'm going to just open up the door for a lot of people to take it seriously and to look at it. And by the same token, the people who are believers, you know, the very talented or gifted psychic people walking around, I mentioned I teach this, and I teach people who come to me at all different stages, you know, but most of them have been really hurt as young, either as kids or young adults, because people made fun of them. They told them they were weird, or they got really angry because they accurately predicted that, you know, that somebody was going to die, or, you know, all kinds of things. And so they shut down a lot, and they don't know how to explain how they get this kind of information. They just do. And so this book is also meant for them, because it's finally a way that they can come back to other people and say, yeah, well, it's normal. Of course I'm getting this information. This is not crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, hitting back to what you said before about we normally develop these abilities and we'll start to show these abilities up until the age of 6 or 7 or so. My girlfriend's niece, they were driving past a graveyard and she was looking out the window and waving and going, hi. And the adults in the car were like, holy, freaking out a little bit. And it was funny as you mentioned the number of years and stuff, because I think it was the Jesuits who believed that, what was it? If you give me a boy till the age of 7, I will give you the man for life, or something along those natures. So those development years are crucial because they essentially lock in a lot of ways your personality and your perception of the world and things like that. So I was just wondering, how can you kind of account for that? How can you change that? How can you actually encourage people from a very early age to notice those psychic abilities, know what they mean, and actually use them in their daily life in a proper way? Like, you've experienced a proper benefit. Like, you've seen that you've become a better lawyer from having this. So somebody could probably become a better auto mechanic. Somebody could become a better radio show host. Somebody could become a better filmmaker or any profession, probably, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's because you get put onto the superhighway of information. You just get it faster, and you move faster, you make better, faster decisions than you do if you have to be doing this kind of slow, pedantic, you know, fact-checking, sequential type of thinking. You just move faster. And I do think it's trainable. You know, I tell a story in my book about... I had the opportunity to get to know somebody named Ingo Swann, who basically created the field of remote viewing for the CIA. And at one point, he had said to me, we were talking, and he reaches into his desk or something, says, all right, tell me what you see. And he's showing me a folded piece of paper. And you can't make anything out of it. You just can't see it. There are no bulges. There are no outlines. There's no nothing. It's just a folded piece of paper. So what do you see? And I went into, of course, I wasn't expecting it. And at that point, I didn't think of myself as in any way psychic. I was just, you know, researching this. I said, I don't know. And I got really nervous. I said, well, how about cufflinks? And he said, no, you're way too nervous. Calm down. Close your eyes. What do you see? And I then described, I said, okay, I see two pipes. Okay, what else? I don't know, I see these squares. Okay, what else? I see sprockets. And I'm thinking to myself, what the heck does a sprocket mean? But it's, you know, I've already said it, and I don't know why I said it. And he said, all right, open your eyes. and he opens up this folded up paper, and I see that it's a pair of diamond earrings. And he says, look, here's your square. That's the, he points to the stone. Here's your pipe. That's the stem of the earring. And here's your sprocket. It's the back piece of the earring. And the way I explain this in my book is I said, you know, if you were a space alien and you came to Earth, you didn't know what things were called. You didn't know what their purpose was. And you couldn't even relate them spatially that well in terms of space. Like, how do they fit together? But you're just sort of describing it. It's a synonym. It's a psychic synonym for an earring. Your regular logical person who already knows the word and the meaning of the word of earring is going to say earring. But somebody who doesn't is going to describe it this way. And that's why skeptics get really annoyed with psychics. You know, say, well, how come you didn't say that? You know, you weren't very precise. Well, there's a reason for that. We're working with a right hemisphere of our brain, and we're looking at things non-verbally, non-linguistically, and the best that we can do is to describe them. So it's a whole different process, but that's how you start to train to do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering, also, we talked about how it can benefit you and anything, and I want to tell you, like, I think, what have I got down here? Like, four stories of synchronicity and weird stuff that's happened to me. So, have you ever heard the song Electric Avenue?
Yeah.
You know, we've got the poster. I was coming out of a wedding, and there I was filming, and the song plays in my head.
We got the bus down to Electric Avenue.
And I was like, well, that's weird. Why did that song pop in my head? It wasn't playing. It wasn't anywhere. Get in my car, turn on the radio, and the song starts.
We got the bus down to Electric Avenue.
And it was like, whoa, I noticed, okay? I picked up on something before it happened, and I noticed that I noticed it, you know?
Right.
I saw little benefit. And have you ever seen the video of the guy with the double rainbow?
No.
No?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God, it's a double rainbow! What does it mean? What does it mean? Oh, my God! And the guy's crying and stuff like that, and he's filming this double rainbow. It's a hugely popular YouTube video. It's freaking hilarious to watch. And I don't know what it meant that I heard that song before it played. I know. And there's a couple of other things that have happened. Like, I remember one time I was coming from my car and from the car to going up to my old flat and stuff like that, there's a washing line in the way where I hang all my washing out. It had been sunny the whole day. The forecast was fine and it was great. And something told me, Vinny, take that frickin' washing down right now. It's going to rain. And I was like, why am I telling myself that? Like, look, the sky's freaking blue. And I ignored it. And I went upstairs. Within something like 10 minutes, clouds had appeared and it started bucketing downwards rain and wet all my washing. Frack! I should have listened to myself. And I think much more recently, you might have heard there's a new film come out called Dread about this famous comic book called Judge Dredd. And it's like a Gender 21 future where everybody's trapped in a megacity and there's these ultimate judges, you know, stuff like that. And I had this inkling in my mind, watch Dredd, watch Judge Dredd. And there's an older version back in 1994, and I downloaded it and watched it on the computer a number of times. And I was like, why am I being compelled to watch this? Is there a new... There needs to be a new Dredd movie coming out. There needs to be a new Dredd movie. And then about 2-3 weeks later, advertisements start playing in New Zealand that there is a new Dredd movie coming out. So I saw it before it happened. And I knew intuitively that there was a new movie coming out. And I didn't know why. I didn't see the benefit in knowing about it before it happened. How could I capitalize on that? You know, it's kind of like useless information, but it's still there nonetheless. And the last story I wanted to tell you was something that I found did have a meaning. I was coming down to my car and something told me, Vinny, you need to practice getting out your key incredibly quickly, opening that door and getting in the car and then slamming the door behind you and then getting the car started and getting the hell out of there as quickly as possible. And I did. I actually pulled that car door so fast out that I cut myself around the chest with the edge of the car door. I was like in a panic, in a rush to get into that car and to get the hell out of there. And then a couple of weeks later, this dude who I was working for at the time, who I later found out was a bit of a cult leader, I went down with a friend of mine to expose this scumbag. And my friend got assaulted. I got assaulted. And we were kind of trapped by him and this gang member and stuff like that who were trying to get us. And my friend held them back and he said, "Go for the car, bro." And I ran for the car. I opened the door up perfectly. I got the key into the door without any equivocation. Perfectly. I got the door open. I got in the car. I turned on the car key. I got my friend in the car and we got the hell out of there and we were safe. So that experience taught me essentially that when I have these little inklings, no matter how crazy they are, follow them. Okay, they some of them mean something, some of them mean nothing, and you'll get no benefit from them. But the point is, you've got to really be trying to notice.
You're absolutely right on. I mean, that's absolutely dead on correct. When I was telling you that I had these like little experiences when I was a kid, but I didn't think anything of them. It was for exact that reason. I couldn't understand why would I get that information. You know.
Oh, Nancy, we're coming to break. In fact, I really want to touch on that, and I'm going to put a note down here to get back to that after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Gentlemen, you listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We try to keep it bangster, you know. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. And I got to mention to people on here, when you got plans, okay, like here's what I'm going to do today with this, that, and the other, your plans come to fruition if you stick to them. I feel that if you feel that it's necessary to absolutely plan everything, then what you do is you cancel out any possibility in your life for synchronicity or coincidence or strange and interesting things. Because, no, we're not going to stop at this gas station to look at this Barbie museum. No, we're sticking to the plan. You cut yourself off if you're really sure about what it is that you're doing in a lot of ways. I like to be unsure about what I'm doing. And as a direct result, I experience so many interesting things, some of which don't make sense to me, some of which do. But every single one of them is very interesting in itself. Now, Nancy, before we got off to break, you were talking about the information you receive as a child kind of normally falls by the wayside because we don't kind of understand what it is we're seeing. I mean, would you like to expand on that at all?
Yeah, sure. But before I do that, because I'm going to forget what you were just talking about, which is, you know, kind of allow yourself to wander through an unplanned life and see what happens, which I think is great. And I got to tell you that since I decided to just put trust into that state of existence, I don't really have a problem getting a parking spot anymore. I used to. I don't understand it. I go exactly wherever it is I want to be going, and I just kind of trust that whatever, it's just going to happen. And pretty much, I would say 99% of the time, it just does.
Me too, Nancy. I have no trouble finding parking spots. None.
Okay.
Well, it's been a long time since I've had trouble finding a parking space.
And don't tell me that that's because you got your own private parking space.
No.
Okay.
So it's because I steal everybody else's.
Okay. Well, you see,
it's called It's called privatization.
I was going to say was that you get all this like crazy information. You're obviously you do have precognitive clairvoyant type of abilities. I mean, because you're picking up this information, it's just not always useful. And that was my problem. And the story that I have, I was about 13 years old. I was at a friend of mine's house and we're talking about ghosts upstairs in her bedroom. And her mom calls us down. We go down to have dinner. And at that point in my life, I never watched TV, you know, or, you know, maybe an hour or two a week, but I wasn't really allowed to watch it. So I didn't know what the TV programs were. And we're sitting down there with her family, and this woman comes out. She's wearing like this French maid costume, and it's like burned into my memory. And before she opens her mouth, I know exactly what she's going to say. And then she says it, and I jump out of my chair and I said, "Oh, I knew what she was going to say. I knew it." And of course, everybody's looking at me like I'm out of my mind. Because she said this most ridiculous thing about, you know, cooking a chicken. And I forget about the fact that I'm saying, well, this is completely useless information. But even at the age of 13, I'm saying, well, how the heck did I know that? You know, because I can't stand it when people say to me, you know, you ask them, well, how'd you know that? And they say, I don't know. I just knew it. What does that mean? So in my mind, I realized that I had heard the voice of her father describing what this character on this TV show was going to be doing and saying. So I said, did you talk about this when I was here? And my friend said, well, actually he did, but he was telling my brother, but it was 3 hours before you got here. So
like a residual energy in the room that you picked up on.
It could have been, yeah, many, many different things. If it goes back to what you actually said at the very beginning of this show, or this segment, wherever we're on, and you said that you have to, if you're going to get into this kind of work, you have to deconstruct and reconstruct your concept of what is the universe and what is time. Because if all things exist simultaneously, it means we theoretically have access to information from all times. You just have to know how to access it. And it's all vibrational. And that's what this is all about. I mean, time doesn't really matter. And when you're doing things, you know, when you're getting precognitive information or your clairvoyance or remote viewing, whatever it is you're doing, you're actually picking up data that's impossible according to our laws of physics and everything else because it's too far away in terms of either distance or time. But you get it, which means it's accessible.
That's true. And I got another story to share with you here. I think my very first girlfriend, we were traveling back on the bus to come to my mum's house, and she revealed to me on the bus that her parents hit her in this. And when we got back home, mum said hello to her and things like that, and she went inside, and mum pulls me aside and she goes, "Does she get hit by her parents, Vinny?"
Well,
you know, my mum has a lot of ability in that sense. She used to do harmonization and stuff like that. Like you can say I'm hurting or something, and she'll be able to point exactly at the point in your body where the pain is.
Yeah.
So is this in some case genetic? Like if your parents are psychically gifted or something like that, you'll be passed on, or is it all in the upbringing?
Yeah, I think you got a pretty good shot. Yes, a lot of it is. I think in a lot of cases it is genetic because it has to do with the structure of our senses. So I do think that it is probably genetic in many cases, but it can also be, as I mentioned, it can be trained. I don't think we're stuck with it simply as like an issue of DNA because I don't think that that's 100% of what it's all about. And by the way, I can do that too. And I don't know why, but once I started to pay attention to that, I realized I can feel people's energy. Usually it's about 5 inches, you know, I hold my hand about 5 inches above their body, and I can very, very often identify specifically where an injury is or where pain is. So there's a, you just have to learn how to pay attention, because if it doesn't, and it's very subtle energy, and it's not like our, you know, our normal five senses are pretty strong vibrationally, and they kind of block out everything else. So if you don't give this a chance, you won't experience it.
I have a similar ability myself, not the same, but similar. I like to massage and things like that. And I've massaged a lot of people over my life. And when somebody's really, really in pain, if I've got my hands on that area, the longer I massage and it starts instantly, I get the shooting pain up through my thing. It's like I'm sharing theirs to a degree. If I'm giving somebody a massage and they're not feeling bad or anything like that, I feel no pain in my hands. If they feel absolutely terrible and I'm actually working the pain out, it actually kind of draws out of them and into me and then dissipates and disappears.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I have plenty of friends who are body workers and that kind of thing. And they say very, very similar things. A lot of times also they'll get imagery. I don't know if you get imagery. You know, where you're just kind of, your energy's been kind of merged into that person, and all of a sudden you're starting to know things about them.
No, I haven't received that imagery or anything like that yet. I'm kind of like I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot, to tell you the truth, Nancy. It's kind of why I regretted instantly after getting you on in the first segment that I didn't get you on for the first hour as well. I really want to figure this out. And I want to develop what skills and abilities are there for me, because I believe that those abilities will enable me to help other people in more ways than I'm helping them now.
They do. And as far as I'm concerned, it's all about service and to others. And I mean, that's what I try and do when I'm doing private readings. I mean, I'm trying to help people in whatever way it takes, whether it's some type of, you know, a psychic reading of their energy, whether it's mediumship through the energy of, you know, people that they've known, they've lost, medical intuitive work or energy work. It's in service of others. And if you have that ability that you can see something that might be invisible to them, share it with them, because that's what it's all about.
I think it basically, you have a deeper connection to humanity, and thus it obligates you to serve humanity via these intuitive whims that we get, yeah?
Yeah, it does. And by the way, I mean, people who abuse it, who get a little bit too caught up in the money angle, or, you know, trying to figure out the stock market or the lottery or whatever it is that they're focused on, the abilities will disappear. They'll just dry up.
Oh my God, that's so funny. My friend John Eisen, he does Uncensored magazine here in New Zealand. He dreamt the lottery numbers, went to his psychic friend. His psychic friend said, play the numbers. So he played the numbers that week and they didn't come up. And he's like, well, that's stupid, man. And he's just like, whatever. And two or three more lotteries go through and then the numbers come up and he didn't buy a ticket. He goes back to his psychic friend and she says to him, you freaking idiot, man. Do you think they'd tell you the numbers on the exact week that the lottery would be played? Ugh, amateur. Classic, eh? You know, you got to keep your sense of humor about this stuff, because otherwise, hey, it'll drive you nuts if you keep trying to revisit it with no ability to get relief from it. But Nancy, thank you so much. And I'm going to have you on the show again sometime, quite frankly.
I really had a good time and I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All right. TheSkepticalPsychic.com, ladies and gentlemen, and the archives will be up at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com in just a few hours, hopefully. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Nancy, thank you for yours, and we'll see you all again sometime, assuredly.